If you are brave enough to sing through darkness, then light will sing through you and for you. Sri Chinmoy. Chapter 17. Newer York. By winter I was barely strong enough to make it back to Asia. My health had crumbled again, so I could no longer work, but I was not ready to accept another collapse like before. In addition to my familiar incapacity, I seemed to have developed chronic pain, mostly in my head and shoulders, or sometimes in my whole body, even the tiny muscles of my fingers and toes. In denying my condition, hoping day after day that I would miraculously recover, I probably only drove it deeper. The struggle seemed milder in the tropic charm of Malaysia and in the balm of the master's presence. But by the time I reached home again, I was limp as a doll. Despite my longing to be of use, I only dragged slower through my days, selfish by default in order to preserve my scant reserves. Although the lavish care of my family and friends saw me to August, I knew by then I had to face reality. I must exercise my oneness by receiving, as there was simply nothing left to give. Swallowing a dry morsel of pride, I asked my mother if I could come back to her. She sounded only relieved that I had accepted the illness and could thus perhaps begin to heal. For the first time ever, I realized how I missed my beloved England instead of trying to escape it as I had done since before I could remember. There was a small Sri Chinmoy Center in York where I could attend meditations twice a week. Once again I sought my guru's blessings for the move and prepared for a new life. In previous months when I had still been able to work but could not do many of the other things I loved, like running or singing for the public, I had filled the gap by learning how to build and look after websites. It was a pastime and a means of additional service then, but by the time I went back to York it was the only occupation I could manage at all, and still only for brief stretches. Although the channel of my usefulness had narrowed, at least it had not sealed up altogether, so I was all the more glad of that technical and artistic outlet. It was the best hope of supporting myself over time, and it also seemed to match my soul's purpose of giving to all those around me, potentially to the wide world. Sri Chinmoy's maxim, never give up, turned in my mind and heart like a mantra as I packed away my things, leaving Wales for a new scene in the play of life whose script I had yet to see and learn. Whatever I endured, I remembered what unknowable pain and incapacity I had escaped one August day on the westbound M5. It was 10 years since I had returned from Thailand and first struggled through a bout of some peculiar illness, thinking I would bounce back in time. But a decade on I was no nearer understanding it. I could prod at reasons for the ebb and swell of my strength, but every theory of mine or anyone else's was soon proven wrong. If there was either cause or pattern, it was apparently beyond any human power to expose it. My health was entirely in God's hands, as changeable and ungovernable as the weather. As the saying goes amongst runners, there is no such thing as bad weather, only inappropriate clothing. In the same way, I was determined not to use the inclemency of my health as an excuse for complete inaction or a cause for complaint. I would simply fit my life as best I could to the inconstancy, weatherproof my days with meditation, and endeavour to retain my smile. I had improved somewhat by the next Christmas trip, which was to begin a manageable flight away in Turkey, then on to Bulgaria. The whole adventure sparkled with new joy and little miracles. My first roommate would arrive a few days late, so I stayed by myself for a while. One afternoon I came in to find a single gerbera in a tiny vase on the desk. It seemed to have been put there very deliberately, with a neat array of foliage behind, but without a card. It was not a special day for me. I wondered if the hotel had put one in each room for hospitality, but I asked a few friends and they had received no such floral gesture. I waited to see if someone had sent it on a whim or in playfulness, knowing it was my favourite, but nobody owned up. Though it was a small thing, often the small things mean the most. As the days unfolded, I realised that whoever had sent it had done so unconditionally. However it came there outwardly, I decided it had come from God, and I treasured it all the more. Sri Chinmoy loved circuses. There happened to be a Mongolian troop in a tent along the road from our hotel in Antalya, and the master decided we would all go along one evening. We took two entire sides of the audience, bundled up against the cold on plastic garden chairs. I arrived a little late to find there was only one seat left in the area where my singing friends had gathered, behind and to the side of my guru's place. The ground was only gravel. The primary coloured canvas of the tent was tired and grubby, but the master's armchair had been brought in and draped with clean white blankets. I could not see him, only the peak of his hat, and beyond his sleeve the fingers of a glove, slightly too long for the neat little fingers they contained. For an hour or more we watched the performers in their sparkles and silks, beaming smiles and ruddy cheeks, jumping and flipping and balancing with athletic ease. To be so near my guru, to enjoy the same innocent spectacle in the same earthly time, was a waking dream to me. I had amused myself at home by preparing a rhyming play, that time with proper painted masks and props. I was glad to bring some enjoyment to the players and the audience, even with my sparse energy, so I wrote a second story for fun while I was there, using the same costumes. I slept longer than usual the morning after the second performance and dreamed of my guru. He was speaking to me in Bengali, the way an adult would to a tiny child, knowing the meaning could not be grasped, but conveying such joyous affection in his smile and eyes that the words did not seem to matter. One of Sri Chinmoy's closest disciples approached me later that day in the lobby. She said how much she had enjoyed the play and that she had brought up the subject with the master in the morning as he went for his early drive. "Guru, isn't she brilliant?" she had said to him. Imitating his response, she nodded back her head in the same dismissive way as he had done the day before I received my name. "Cha," he had replied. "They are all my stories." She pressed him further to praise my interpretations, but he did not yield. "They are my stories. She is writing from my stories," he volleyed, apparently with mounting irritation, and then changed the subject. She seemed apologetic, as though her efforts had failed. Little did she know how much sweetness I juiced from those words and descriptions, though, far more than if my guru had conceded to give me credit or had made an example of me in public. Any outer acknowledgement would have seemed synthetic compared to the fondness I had felt in my dream, a dream that was probably taking place at the same time as the seemingly dismissive outer conversation. To me, the whole incident was the dearest proof that my inner connection to him was all that mattered. Far from being disappointed, I only laughed, softly and secretly, over and again. It was simply his way with me, and I would not have exchanged it for any other way. Most days the master would call Pari's group in the functions and give us special prasad, as well as the group of boys, similar in number, who attended him at Aspiration Ground and during trips. He would often throw the items for us each to catch in turn, and seemed to enjoy the sport immensely. While it was a signal honour to receive prasad by hand, the mere thought of it caused my own palms to glisten and my heart to launch into a gallop. I was simply an awful catch. However I prayed and concentrated, I would almost always drop the precious offering from my guru's hand, no matter its shape or the way it was thrown. I was not the only one who missed. Some were notorious for dropping, and others would do so occasionally. The master was still a nimble sportsman even then. Sometimes with a mischievous glint in his eye, he would make a person run or jump for fun by throwing out of bounds. He usually gently teased anyone who missed, but with me he said nothing, presumably because I was already plainly mortified. One girl in our group had a birthday in Bulgaria and had brought some chocolates from home as our prasad. They were fine pralines, wrapped in pleated foils of all different colours, tied with a coordinating ribbon and a dainty silk flower. "Please, please, do not drop these," implored the master. "Very special, very beautiful prasad." In line, I prayed intensely for the capacity. Just once could I not do such a simple thing? I stepped up and held my breath, pinning my eyes like a kestrel to the tiny parcel as it left my guru's hand. Not only did I miss, but also in lunging forward to catch it, I kicked it under a display of plants. The only choice was to crouch and grovel for it in front of everyone, while the whole line waited behind me. In the scheme of things, it was a small incident, but at the time I made it a symbol of a much wider uselessness. I returned to my seat on the fourth row and hung my head in tears, sulking with God for not hearing my plea and wishing the ground would embrace me. 10 hearts are left. Oh ho, who will get them? The master's chuckles were enough for me to glance up before delving again into the swamps of my new misery. There were similar chocolates, heart-shaped and all in red foil, arranged beautifully in a separate box. He called out the names of those along the front row and threw a pleated heart to each of their seats. 2 more only, he said, and called to someone further back. Then there was only one. Even with my head bent as low as it would go, I noticed the 2 girls in front of me diving apart to avoid something as it whistled past their ears. I felt a sudden sting on my forearm. The master had thrown the last heart, shot like an arrow from a bow, without so much as a curve in its trajectory. He had not called my name, but my attention had not been needed anyway, since the effort was all his own. A long pink glow showed where the foil had met my skin. The heart was resting where it landed, in the crook of my right arm. From that day I was able to catch any item from my guru, even those thrown askew in mischief. Bulgaria had been cold at first. No amount of clothing would stop my teeth from chattering. All had looked empty and somewhat stark, yet each day became a fuller, friendlier blossom than the last. I searched for the rising sun from breakfast on our last morning, but the trees were hiding it. My shawl was already packed away, and I wore only a sheer sari and little sandals. I stepped out, folding my arms tightly, my bare toes cringing instinctively, but the assault never came. The air was bright and mild. I followed an overgrown stairway to the sea, where the sun drizzled light like a spilling bowl of nectar, changing constantly beneath the cloud. The sea waves were only little tremors of joy and anticipation. Outer events in that 3-week sojourn melted into one fine stream of thanks. The weather's transformation seemed a perfect echo of my own inner renovation in the daily presence of my guru. It was a year newer than any other I had known, and I felt I was running to greet it like a child. Back in my childhood home, I peep into the sunroom and look on the napping faces of those who call me daughter. Tears come from nowhere. There sits sacrifice in 2 human forms, in 2 adjacent armchairs. One bore me, one claimed me. Both gave so much of their combined lives for the enrichment of mine. I work in the tiny room that was my brother's. It would not offer him enough space even for visiting now that he has a family of his own. I will be an aunt again soon for the 2nd time. I laugh out loud at the adult roles we play when I still think of us as children. Laughter was never in short supply, even when there was really nothing to laugh about, and still we always seemed to find it. We giggled breathlessly over old photographs the last time he came up north. The hairstyles, outfits and expressions. Silence came suddenly when we reached one of me holding his hand, watching a deer. He knock-kneed in little shorts and a head of curls. I much taller in a yellow pinafore. It struck me anew that families are not born randomly, that maybe they have a depth of significance only the heart can understand. Is this even the same life? Am I the same girl who moved up north a quarter century before? These city walls stood for a millennium, but in the wink of time since my teens, are they so changed? Through my open window, breezes bring the bells of the minster, surging like a tide. Strangers smile at me in the road, one, two, three, before I realise I was already smiling, and they perhaps politely returning. Was that old cherry tree there in those days too, hurling confetti into a brilliant sky, like the mother of some cherished bride? Is that the River Inn where once I turned 16 in a frenzy of loud friends and a cheap euphoria of cider, my feet lolling in the watery green? There are other loud frenzies now, and some look my current age. Is their joy as hollow as my own once was, as fickle as a draught? Are they still wondering, is this all? Is this it? It was not this place that was dull then, it was these eyes that saw it so, and these same eyes that see it perfect now. I am home, and in a city I once thought could never fit me. There is a building by the railway in town, made into 8 little abodes. I saw it in the autumn newspapers, and thought I recognised it as I had done with my Welsh flat. It disappeared again through winter. Now it is back, I show it to my mother, even though we both know I am not earning enough for it yet. Come on then, let's go and have a look. But what if I fall in love with it? Just from the outside. House prices have further skyrocketed. My home in Cardiff, by now with a plush square of honeysuckle and other greenery at the back, sold for nearly twice what it cost me. But I would only get a one-room studio for the same price in York. Most of the ones in agency photographs look more like hutches or cells than homes, or they are far enough out of town to be called somewhere else. This one is almost sitting on the rail tracks, but it lies only just beyond the city walls. It looks like an old stable, or something transplanted from a farmyard, and aside from the trains, it has an almost bucolic air of peace about it. Oh dear, it's perfect, isn't it? Yes. Inside, where we had sworn not to go, is wall-to-wall squalor, but we both already know it is too late to unlove it again. The bathroom suite is so old it must have been put in second hand. A hole in the tub is patched with glue and tape, and there was never a shower at all. Linoleum is stuck down to soggy chipboard that squeaks and bounces. The walls are creamy and shiny, like the skin that forms on hot milk. Up a ladder in the eaves is a square shelf where a bed would fit. Its window cannot remember the last time it was opened. Black canvas, like a giant pirate's patch, is tacked over it with pins. Dark mould crawls up the glass underneath and between its twin panes. Apart from the floorboards, walls and window frames, everything will have to go. Our matronly financial advisor finds me a back door into some seemingly impossible plan. Providence seems to have everything in hand. I am already signing sheaves of paper covered in numbers and foreign phrases like self-certification and stamp duty. Luckily, I have always been surrounded by engineers who have miraculous ideas in the middle of the night for storage or drainage or light fittings, so all I have to think of is colours. 6 men come at once, with 6 sets of tools. The floor is covered in dust and cables. The walls are covered in wet plaster and new holes, some in the wrong places, and we all wonder what we have started. We clean and sand and paint. I leave my brother to lay the floor and my parents to fit an entire kitchen while I go to celebrate my guru's birthday in America. Before I know it, my new home is full of the morning sun, even under the white blinds that veil its skylights like Japanese paper screens. Everything is white in different textures save the glossy golden floor of shaved bamboo, textiles in leafy yellow greens, and kitchen walls the colour of a Granny Smith apple. I have brought home new work, and my strength is doubled despite the strains of renovation. Everything is quiet unless a train rumbles by, or the bell ringers practice at the Minster, or the children play outside the nearest school. Everything is clean and new. Even inside me there is a twinkling clarity, like the sort that comes after a heavy rain. Where did such perfection come from? Is it here to stay? Our guru is gone to the other world, comes a voice through the receiver. It feels like learning to swim, like plunging alone into cold, deep water. How am I to bear myself forward? All my strength seems absorbed in merely staying afloat. My struggles have no purchase but dissolve instead, lost entirely in loose ripples. There is nothing to hold and not enough gravity, yet the sucking weight of my own self forces the breath out of me. Suddenly I am making the familiar flight to America, but in uncharted circumstances. Muffling sobs that spring up unbidden, I walk down the covered gangway, past the rows of newspapers and clusters of airport workers in fluorescent bibs. The inescapable smell of the airplane interior seeps out of the door, mixed with a blast of jet fuel, and I realize I did not say goodbye. Through all the years I have been to see my guru, I have said my farewells to him in my heart before departing again, thinking it could be the last time I rest my eyes on him, for any number of reasons. I always took an inner snapshot as he made his way slowly to the side entrance of Aspiration Ground, tottering like a child in the latter times and holding onto the gate's frame to steady himself before disappearing into a car. I cannot remember the last bittersweet moment, sometime in August celebrations. Like inauspiciousness, perhaps I simply could not countenance my earthly parting from him. People are piling their coats in the overhead lockers. I buckle the cold metal around my middle and lose myself in memories. The evening was diamond clear. A white moon reclined behind skeletal trees. One trunk held out many pristine arms and hands of long-petaled blossom in a shower of purity. A canopy of white paper banners reflecting their softness glimpsed over stone walls. In the still air we waited, each holding a single rose. I caught the scent and felt the cold stem in my hands as my eyes absorbed its colour. All was simple in my mind and sight. I only waited with a band of friends, just a bloom for my senses, preparing to offer my heart in sound. One followed another into the sanctity of Aspiration Ground. Gravel grinding underfoot gave way to the softer, powdered floor. Between two stone lions, along a bank of carefully tended spring flowers, the warm scent of hyacinths leapt out from the crisp night. I had felt hints of it in other places dedicated to prayer and meditation, or in simple places of natural beauty. That living stillness, abundant silence, gentle clarity. But those places were homes to other people. I was in my dearest home, my own favourite place in the world, basking in something far beyond the world's mesh and material. There was nowhere else I would be than in that outdoor room, in the vibrant open air, singing with devotion to God before my guru, who had given my life the wings of its inspiration. That moment was the prize of many hours spent alone in concentration on the songs, many more in company learning the subtleties of the music, to sing as if with one voice, beyond individuality, merging sound with sound, breath with breath, far from thought and into the heart of music itself. The last thing I remember clearly was the master receiving treatment from doctors in the early evenings at Anambrahma. Pari's group was allowed to sit on the floor behind a screen, each taking turns to start a song. It was hot, and the restaurant girls made us juices, passing them from hand to hand along the makeshift rows. Sometimes Sri Chinmoy would join in with our singing or hum along. Sometimes he would call out requests. After the session, the screen was folded away and he perched on the edge of the couch with a plastic sack of potato chips, throwing the little packets to each of us as we filed out the door. I remember the end of one function, possibly my last. It was a typical heavy August night, silent but for the choir of cicadas. The master was sitting on the longest side of aspiration ground as the tables were brought for prasad. I waited until the crowds had thinned and went down with the last trickles of girls. Once my arms and hands were laden, I looked up to find my guru in a serious attitude, with eyes wide open. But seeing my smile, his own face spread into a particular warm grin as I had only seen him give to others. I wondered then how strange it was for him to make a special smile for me. That was not usually our way. But he neither checked himself nor broke eye contact until I had moved out of sight. I realize only now that smile was to last me a lifetime. It was not necessarily deserved, but it would need to sustain me until heaven. I remember there were gold lockets for sale once in the daytime that August. They contained transcendental pictures and the master was to bless them. I thought there would be other chances, but I happened to have the exact money in my pocket, given me by a client just moments before. I placed the little pendant on its red velvet pouch and held it up on the flat of my palm for my guru's blessing. Outwardly, a blessing usually comprised a brief gesture of the hand, symbolic of a far deeper, inner benediction. The hand that I had always tried so carefully to avoid touching by mistake came straight down on mine, though, so I had to rivet my back foot into the ground to stay balanced. It was as though he was reaching through my skin and bone to my very heart in a final signal of oneness. I already treasured the pendant then. Little did I know how precious and singular it would become. Years ago, I remember watching Sri Chinmoy walk down the drive one day, and I saw in his face only a living, breathing, transcendental picture. One is a photograph of the other, but I still had not reconciled those seemingly disparate gurus. Although I never saw it so clearly again, my meditations at home and at the centre acquired more depth and meaning after that. The difference between knowing logically and feeling from my own experience was at once tiny and immense. From then I was certain that although he would depart the earth one day, my guru would not leave me. The guru and his picture were synonymous. The inner life could not end with the outer form. Until I had been to New York, I had thought weather, bucketing rain or beating sun or biting cold, had the power to hamper happiness. In time, I found that as long as one has a sun hat or a raincoat or a pair of good mittens, or sometimes all three in a day, the only resistance is in the killjoy mind. I remember one April morning waiting on the bleachers at Aspiration Ground for the master to arrive. It was snowing a little at first, but I had wrapped up cosily and had plenty of songs to learn. Occasionally I trudged across the road to buy hot chocolate. Other than that, I stayed for 6 hours until I heard for certain that he would not be coming out. By then only a few people remained, and the snow was falling in feathery clumps. Yet there, in the pure, silent softness, my inner guru felt so near, and I did not want to leave. That I could meditate so easily without his presence was instruction in itself, instruction that I treasure all the more now, knowing however long I wait on the bleachers, he will not come out again. Now I stand on the side of Aspiration Ground where once a fairground carousel turned with stately grace, its passengers perched on exquisite painted animal seats, surrounded by all the associated braid and bunting. Tiger, deer, buffalo, bull, lion, elephant. Each rider seemed ageless, wearing the smile of a mesmerized child in the glow of shaded sunlight. Dreamlike organ music filled the air. Sri Chinmoy reclined, powering the entire apparatus with his feet on two simple pedals. The night is full of stars and candles, and silence is the only music now. I realize in how many ways he has taught me to rebuild my own innocence. I once thought I had been indelibly defiled by my worldly life and my own mistakes, but instead I am newer by the day. I join the line of white-clad figures come from around the world to pay their respects to the Master's physical form. There seems yet more love between us all than ever there was before. I take a little flame in a jar and place it by the open casket, but in those silent moments that are only my own, I do not find my guru lying prone in a satin dhoti. He is gone from that earthly habitat. The tautness of suspense that always hovered around his activities and around the meteoric flow of his creations has vanished and can never be recovered. Nothing is gone from aspiration ground, though. Nothing is gone from the transcendental picture. Nothing is gone from my heart. Everything is different now, and everything is still the same. He was never to be found or lost like other people anyway. It is as though he always was, and thus ever will be. With that immortal strength beside me and within, I traverse eternity. Sweet frankincense, a clarion scent, a heralding of saints or kings. Squirrel sprints in gathering, but sun leaps out of climb, breaking its faith with autumn time. One tardy bee labours long, humming low a working song, treading cheery and meticulous. Vines thread red necklaces, jars of flame glitter fast amongst petals. Alive, alive, a peace of ages settles deep inside this verdant plush. Some rearrange in gentle rush, all in white with ardent care. Others sing into the empty air. Hush, hush, go the footfalls, soft on gravel. In me, memories unravel, long tapes of smiling scenes from in this leafy room. Tap, 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 tap. Today they build my master's tomb. Though I tremble at the sound, would there be an ending to a light eternal? Sorrow is a page within the journal of delight.